This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, Truth in Broadcasting.
You know, I think maybe Americans are starting to figure it out. Maybe a little bit is starting to seep through the cracks. This fundamental notion that that commercial interests, that profit, while it's a fine thing for creating prosperity, and we all want prosperity, I'm not knocking that at all. It doesn't create democracy. That there is a dynamic tension between democracy and commerce, or between democracy and the profit motive. And that dynamic tension needs to be maintained to create a vibrant democracy. You need both. And what's happened is welcome to the program. Tom Hartman here with you. Bang. I mean, what got me started on this thing is Michael Moore yesterday on CNN. It's just incredible. And I'll get to that in just a second. But I just want to make the big point first. And then I'm going to illustrate it with several examples throughout this hour. And that is that commercial interests will create prosperity, but they will not create democracy. And increasingly, and the way that you have both, by the way, is by having democratically passed laws, small d, democratically passed laws, that is, laws passed by our elected representatives who are reflecting the will of we the people, that constrain the profit motive in a way that it's possible to generate profit, but it doesn't harm the public good. And it does create what was the number one concern of the founding fathers, an informed electorate. This is the reason why they subsidized the distribution of newspapers, special fourth class rate, the postal service from 1776 until 1787 until today delivers newspapers at a loss. Why? Because a well-informed populace was more important in the minds of the founders of this country than low taxes. So, example number one. Example number two. We were talking yesterday about the fairness doctrine. This is a variation on it, and this is what very much should be the case. It used to be that there was an absolute firewall between the news department and the sales department. I worked in news when this was the case. I worked in news from 1971 to 1977, and the radio station where I worked actually had four or five people in our news department. This is a local radio station in the Lansing, Michigan market. I mean, in a small market, a medium-sized market, but we had a news department. And the reason why was because that was the cost of having a license. And the news department never, ever talked to the sales guys. It was just not done. So, if we were doing a story about a company in town, if an auto dealer got busted for ripping off people on repairs or something like that, hey, we just did the story. If they were an advertiser, the sales guys had to deal with it. It wasn't our problem. Remember how it used to be that way in the news? It used to be that way before Reagan suspended not just the Fairness Doctrine, but a whole collection of rules in 1986. And then 10 years later, with the Telecommunications Act, Bill Clinton really flushed it all down the toilet, signing the Telecommunications Act. And now and then what was the first thing that happened? CBS was the first network to announce that they were bringing their news division under the umbrella of their entertainment division. All of it answerable to sales. And again, as I said, this started out. What got me started on this thing was Michael Moore. And this is yesterday. Michael Moore was on Wolf Blitzer. CNN Wolf Blitzer, and will be again today, by the way. Michael Moore has a brilliant movie out now, Sicko, and you got to see this movie, first of all. I'll just put it right out there. This is one of the most amazing movies. I mean, Fahrenheit 9/11 was a brilliant, worldview-changing movie. Sicko is better. And there's another one, by the way, coming down the road. It's going to be released in August that is another brilliant movie that Leonardo DiCaprio has put together called The 11th Hour. You can Google that. There's a link, actually, to that from the top of my website at tomhartman.com. The trailer just went up on MySpace/Trailer Park of Leo DiCaprio's movie about basically all the crises we face and what can we do about them. And I think, frankly, what we can do about them, in part, has to do with this democratic process. So anyhow, here's Michael Moore. Wolf Blitzer, first of all, he runs this piece about, you know, is Michael Moore really telling the truth, moderated in part by Dr. Sanjay Gupta. And it had some errors of fact in it, shall we say. And Michael Moore has corrected those over on his website at michaelmoore.com. But anyhow, here's Michael Moore taking on Wolf Blitzer.
Yeah, I'd like about 10 minutes to respond to
give us a couple headlines, what you'd like to say.
I don't talk in sound bites. So that report was so biased. I can't imagine what pharmaceutical company ads coming up right after our break here.
And bingo, bingo, bingo. I can't imagine what pharmaceutical ad company. Watching CNN yesterday, or actually watching MSNBC yesterday, I saw an ad for America's gas and oil industry. Now, why does America's gas and oil industry feel the need to advertise on the news? I mean, if they want to get the message out to people about how wonderful they are, and they want to get it out to a lot of people, why not advertise on Dancing with the Stars? Why not advertise on the really highly rated shows? I submit to you that the reason why you see ads for defense contractors, the reason why you see ads for oil companies, the reason why you see ads for the big three agricultural combines, who are the recipients of most of the pork in the farm bill, and the reason that you see ads for the natural gas industry, the reason you saw ads for liquefied coal on the news programs is because they don't want the news reporting on those topics. Because that firewall is gone. And we need to bring it back. We absolutely need to bring it back. Because commercial interests don't always work for the best of democracy. In fact, very often, particularly when they start involving themselves in the processes of democracy, this is the basis of Teddy Roosevelt's presidency. In 1901, Teddy Roosevelt, the trust buster, who in 1907 passed a federal law, still on the books, by the way, that made it a felony, although it's been diluted to death. And now the Supreme Court put a nail in the thing 2 weeks ago. Passed a federal law that made it a felony for a corporation to give money to a politician. For any purpose. Anyhow, Michael Moore.
But why don't you tell the truth to the American people? I mean, I wish that CNN and the other mainstream media would just for once tell the truth about what's going on in this country, whether it's with health care. I don't care what it is. I mean, you guys have such a poor track record. And for me to come on here and have to listen to that kind of crap, I mean, seriously, I haven't been on your show now for 3 years. The last time I was on, you'd ran a similar piece about Fahrenheit 9/11 saying, oh, this can't be true, what he's saying about the war, how it's going to be a quagmire, the weapons of mass destruction, you know. And why don't you start off, actually, with my first appearance back here on your show in 3 years, and maybe apologize to me for saying that 3 years ago, because it turned out everything I said in Fahrenheit was true. Everything's come to happen. Everything I said. I mean, I took you in that film, The Walter Reed Hospital. And it took 3 years before you or any of the rest of the mainstream media would go to Walter Reed Hospital and see what was happening to our troops.
So, you know, Michael Moore taking on Wolf Blitzer. And Wolf Blitzer, you know, to his credit, actually kept Moore on for about a 14-minute segment. I mean, it was a long segment, and then recorded another one, which they're going to be playing today, and let Moore just go on and go off on this stuff. But it was one of those rare moments. It was one of those little cracks. And the tragedy is that there are so few of those. There are so very few of those. In the midst of this whole huge debate about, you know, is Katie Couric happy at CBS or not, last night Louise and I decided to watch the CBS Evening News. You know, hey, you know, there's all this publicity about Katie Couric. Let's watch her show. And they did this piece on the highways. America's highways are hurting. 30% of the roads across the country are in poor or mediocre condition. Traffic is up. The roads are falling apart. Did they point out that the reason why is because right-wing nutcases have been running this country for the last 26 years? Seriously. I mean, this is when it started. They do point out this is when it started. It started, you know, in the last 30 years that our roads started falling apart. Do they point out that the right-wing ideology of, oh, taxes are terrible, even if they're to invest in things like roads or schools or hospitals, is the cause of this? No. They say, so why are road repairs stuck in a rut? Well, the cost for materials used to fix pavement has shot up 33% the past 3 years, and the 18.4 cent per gallon gas tax that helps fund highway repairs hasn't been raised in 14 years. That's it. They don't talk about why it hasn't been raised. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
Welcome back. It's the news, indeed, 21 minutes past the hour. By the way, head over to the airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page. That's literally how it's Tom Hartman page. But you just go to airamerica.com and click on my name. It'll take you to our page. And you can start blogging there. There's also links over to our message board area at tomhartman.com and to our live chat room, which is now up and running again. We had a server crash this morning, I guess it was, and this is down for a little while. But anyhow, it's up and running. And but at airamerica.com on the Tom Hartman page, you can post your message to our blog today. And at the end of today's program, 2.5 hours hence, David, our esteemed producer, David Poole, will select his favorite blog entry for the day. And, you know, it might be one that is friendly. It might be one that's funny. It might be one that's hostile. Who knows what's going to tickle David's fancy today? You never know. David's a strange guy. So get over there and post and have fun with it. 22 minutes past the hour. Our joke of the day from LaughingLiberty.com. Despite increasing pressure from members of his own party, President Bush is opposed to setting a date to bring home troops from Iraq. This is odd, considering the president's views on sex education and abortion. You'd think he'd be a fan of early withdrawal. So, oh, yeah, that is a good one. Thank you. Well, as I was saying, the point, and I want to get back to this point, and I think it's a really important one. On the CBS Evening News last night, they didn't point out that the gas tax has not gone up across the United States over the last 20 years because the power of the oil lobby, the power of the asphalt lobby, the power, the oil lobby, the power of the oil lobby and the auto manufacturers has been so great that they have been able to prevent an increase in gasoline taxes that would have paid for those roads to be repaired. And as a consequence, you've got more and more potholes. 30-40% of America's highways are a wreck right now. I mean, they correctly pointed out in the piece that you're already paying for it. I mean, this is a classic example of internalizing profits and externalizing costs. They pointed out in this piece that that is costing, as I recall, I'm skimming through here through the piece here, but apparently it's they said it on the air and it's not in the piece on the website, CBS website, but it was something like $300 to $400 per person per year that we're paying in car repairs that we shouldn't have to pay if our roads weren't full of potholes. So if instead we were paying $300 a year in gasoline taxes, in an added gasoline tax, the roads would be in good shape. The price of gas would be slightly higher, so we'd probably drive a little less, which I think arguably would be a good thing. Not to say, you know, increased gas prices are necessarily a good thing, but we're paying for it anyway. I mean, you know, they went along with this trucker, and he's like, yeah, you know, we're all paying for these lousy roads. We're paying for it at the repair shop, though, instead of via taxes. Why? Well, because repair shops make profit, too. It's like, destroy the idea of the commons. Destroy the idea of us working collectively together. That, essentially, is the conservative agenda in a nutshell. Turn everything over to the corporate interest. Turn everything over to the profit motive. And they really and truly and sincerely believe that somehow if everything is in the hands of the profit motive, If everything is being done by companies or individuals who are doing it for their own self-interest, that somehow over time that's all going to work out and it'll be the best thing for everybody. And the fact of the matter is that no nation on earth has ever successfully functioned in that libertarian context. It's never happened. And it won't. And it's not what the founders put together when they put together this country. When this country was created, it was created with this very, very clear and very explicit idea of the common defense and the general welfare. John in Huntington Beach sends me a note, and thank you for this, John. I don't know if you want your last name used on the air, so I won't toss it out there. But he says, why is it that guys, you know, people always quote the preamble, which talks about promoting the general welfare? He says, in fact, that's the conservatives' argument. It only says promote. It doesn't say provide. The preamble of the Constitution. He said, but they never quote Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, which says that Congress shall, through taxes, etc., quote, provide for the common defense and the general welfare of the United States. End quote. Common defense and general welfare share the same sentence. But the cons want the general welfare part, that is, that stuff that we all do collectively to backstop each other, to provide, for example, for our own health care. Where we started with this whole thing, Michael Moore and Wolf Blitzer. The cons want to move all of that into private hands. They want your Social Security to be handled by Bear Stearns or by Goldman Sachs. They want your health insurance to be handled by Aetna or some HMO. They want every, frankly, I mean, I've had these guys on who talk about, you know, our police department should be privatized. Our fire department should be privatized. Our schools, certainly. Oh, yeah, vouchers. Let's privatize our schools. No. There are some things, and this is what this country was founded on. The idea that this country was founded on, this liberal democracy. There are some things that we collectively do together. Now, we don't want the government making shoes or TVs. I mean, that would be crazy. But public education, public health care, public roads, yeah, good plan. Public transportation, 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
I was raised on God and country, and here I take my stand. You and I are we the people. We're the law in this new land. Stand by JFK.
Stand by JFK.
Against the corporate plan.
Against the corporate plan.
Know that secrecy.
I know that secrecy
is on the paradigm. They can take their oligarchy.
They can take their oligarchy with them down to hell. I'll keep the Constitution and that old Liberty Bell.
I was raised on God's country.
35 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. You know, the firewall that used to exist between the news division and the profit center, the sales department, was such a great excuse for those of us who worked in news back in the 1970s and 1960s. Well, before Reagan, you know, it was such a great excuse to be able to say, you know, we're going to follow the story wherever it leads. And nowadays, news departments don't do that. And they don't do that, obviously, because they're not allowed to do that. And they're not allowed to do that because that firewall isn't there. And the reason that firewall isn't there is because it's the free market. Because that small, very small level of regulation that you must program in the public interest is gone. I'm not talking about the fairness doctrine. I'm talking about programming in the public interest, saying, you know, that real news, regardless of where. Remember when the old joke used to be, you know, it's a bad day. This was the old joke among corporate guys. You know, it's going to be a bad day when you show up for work and CBS's 60 Minutes crew is on your doorstep. They're not saying that anymore. 60 Minutes, more often than not, is doing fluff pieces. Everybody's doing fluff pieces. And Michael Moore again, taking on Wolf Blitzer yesterday on CNN.
So for me to have to sit here and listen again to more crap about socialized medicine or how the Canadians have it, you know, worse than us and all this, all the statistics show that we have a far worse health care than these other industrialized countries. We're the only ones that don't have it free and universal. And, you know, you said that Germany was the only one that was better than us in terms of wait times. The Commonwealth Fund.
Now, they had just done, Sanjay Gupta had just done this report saying that only Germany beats the United States in terms of wait times. And you know, anyhow, so Michael Moore continues.
Last year showed of the top six countries, we were second to last, next to Canada. It showed that Britain, for instance, 71% of the British public, when they call to see a doctor, get to see the doctor that day or the next day. It's 69% in Germany. It's 66% in Australia. And you're the ones who are fudging the facts. You fudge the facts to the American people now for I don't know how long about this issue, about the war. And I'm just curious, when are you going to just stand there and apologize to the American people for not bringing the truth to them that isn't sponsored by some major corporation?
And you know, that's the essence of it. I mean, that was really the essence of what Michael Moore was saying. He, you know, in another part of the interview, he made the point again.
I mean, I'll sit here for as long as it takes if you can do that.
Just
for
to be
me.
In fairness, we had a lot of commercials for Sitco that we've been running on CNN as well. So you know, we have commercials. This is a business, obviously. But let's talk a little bit about one
you
of
have
the.
You have a nightly medical report. You have something called the Daily Dose. I watch CNN. You have it every day. The Daily Dose, sponsored by fill in the blank, and you are funded by these people day in and day out. Don't even compare that to my movie being out for a couple of weeks.
I would say that
ads for 15 seconds.
I don't know if you're familiar with
come
Doc.
On.
I don't know
come
if
on,
you're
Wolf.
No.
And then Wolf goes into this thing about, well, Sanjay Gupta, he's not just a great doctor and a great neurosurgeon, but he's also a great journalist, and you know, he told the truth in this thing. And Moore says no.
All right. So when I now put on my website, as I will do tonight, how his facts were wrong about the $7,000 that we spend. It's actually, I've read one report now, it's even more than $7,000 that we spend per person each year in this country. I'm going to put the real facts up there on my website so people can see what he just said was absolutely
wrong.
Well,
if we get that confirmed, obviously we'll correct the record, Sanjay, but I'm just saying.
Oh, you will. Good.
Obviously, Sanjay Gupta is not only a doctor and a neurosurgeon, but he's also an excellent, excellent journalist. Look, I saw the film, and it's a powerful, powerful.
I saw Dr. Sanjay Gupta over there embedded with the troops at the beginning of the war. He and the others of you in the mainstream media refuse to ask our leaders the hard questions and demand the honest answers. And that's why we're in this war. We're in the fifth year of this war because you and CNN, Dr. Gupta, you didn't do your jobs back then. And now here we are in this mess.
You know, just taking on the military-industrial complex. And I think, frankly, it would be healthy. I think it would be healthy for corporate media to bring back that firewall. Because there's all this, you know, oh, Katie Couric is dying in the polls. She's dying or in the ratings. She's the CBS Evening News is tanking. The average age of the viewers is dead, you know, is 99 plus or whatever. Well, maybe the reason why is because people who want news are not watching the network news anymore because it's all infotainment, because it's fluff, because they don't dig deep any longer because they're afraid to offend this sponsor or that sponsor, this trade group or that trade group, this party or that party. Nobody wants to offend anybody because they're afraid that some advertiser is going to pull their money. Well, if the networks could say to all of their advertisers, we're sorry, our newsroom is out of control. We have no control over them. Which is how it used to be. Edward R. Murrow, I'm sorry, advertiser. He says what he says. We don't have any control over him. It's the law that our entertainment division, our financial department, our sales guys can't go over to the news department and tell them how to program the news. That's the law. And I submit to you that if we went back to that, then we would have it would be a healthier thing for the networks. It would be a healthier thing for radio and television. It would be a healthier thing for local programming as well as national programming. So anyhow, I did rant for the day. By the way, Michael Moore did. It's over at michaelmoore.com. The Sicko Truth Squad sets CNN straight, and they go through and all the points that he was objecting to in the CNN report. He lays out, you know, what was wrong, and then and corrects it and says, "Here's what's right." So anyhow, there you go. Gary in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Gary, welcome to the program.
Oh, hi, Tom. I just love Michael Moore taking Wolf Blitzer to task. It's true, they've never apologized for any of that misinformation that they put out, but that's not what I really wanted to say. I think that, that what you were saying about the highways and the crumbling infrastructure is just typical of how these guys want to work. They defund the schools, and then they point and say, oh, look, the schools aren't working. You know, they let the infrastructure crumble. They say, oh, look, the government can't do anything. But they're defunding it all the while. It's just this sort
of
scam that's been going for years now.
It's the Katrina scam. You're absolutely right. It's the Katrina scam. It's you know, allow the infrastructure, allow the nation to fall apart, and then say, oh, gee, I guess the government can't do these kinds of things, when in fact governments all over the world have done these things, and most of us who are old enough can remember a time in the United States when we did these things, and we don't do them anymore, and we need to get back to that time. Gary, thanks for the call. Dave in Buffalo, New York. Hey, Dave.
Good morning, Tom. Hey, I heard that the CIA has outsourced, or our government has outsourced the CIA and all its secrets, and what does that mean for us?
Well, I don't know that we've outsourced the CIA and all its secrets.
I heard that he has turned it over to corporate America, and corporations are now doing a lot of the investigation and all the secret activity. And
there are certainly some cases where CIA, NSA, and other things like that, where they bring in private contractors, to do work with them. But I don't. Let me look into that, Dave. I mean, maybe there's something there that I'm unaware of. I'm gonna track it down. I appreciate it. Mike in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, Tom. One of the things I wanted to add, after seeing Michael Moore's movie, one of the things I related to was the fire protection of my fellow brother firefighters. I had worked for the second largest private fire protection company in the world. Excuse me. At one time, interesting enough, the largest fire protection, private, for-profit fire protection company was in Sweden at that time. Anyway.
How strange.
Yeah. Well, the thing is that they talk about the privatization of the fire service, or the fact the fire service is part of really a social system. Well, that fire protection company, wow, it was good, and we did some very innovative things. The fact is, because it was for-profit, and it no longer is, it's now been absorbed by the city that it's subscribed to, is that it didn't take care of us as firefighters. We had to run one-man stations, whereas our Phoenix brothers had a minimum of three-man trucks.
Right. If your job is to fight fires, then you do whatever is necessary to fight fires, and then you consider the cost after the fact. Whereas if your job is to make a profit, you consider the cost first, and you consider the profit first, and then you figure out how within the constraints of that to fight fires.
And that's what it came down to. We had to do everything our other guys did, tag the hydrant, lay the line, do the search and rescue, with our nearest backup being 20 to 40 minutes away.
Which is deadly.
That's how they ran the system. Now, I'm not saying it was all bad. We did some innovative work, and they did good work. But if we even mention the word union, you're out the door.
Yeah, yeah. Mike, thanks a lot for the interesting story. And I'm going to have to track that thing down about Sweden. A lot of speculation comes to mind. But in any case, I don't know the facts right now, so I'm not going to talk about it. But I think this is the big issue of our day, frankly. How the war industry helped us get into this war and is wanting us to invade Iran, and how the medical industry is keeping us sick. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
And now what if they are hearing just exactly what you say?
If they're listening to 900 calls, they ought to help you pay.
Soon they'll know your every fetish.
And they'll know Tom Cruise is gay.
I've wondered for so long.
They will know if on his birthday you don't call your Uncle Brent. They will know if you don't call that girl with whom the night you spent. Yes, the White House needs intelligence, but this ain't what we meant. They got the whole thing wrong.
Capital steps there with a great routine. Oh, my. Some things are absolutely nuts out there in the world. I'll tell you, it is just very, very strange. Women are demanding equal rights. Well, that's not strange in and of itself, but a group of Spanish women are calling for equality at Pamplona's famed San Fermín running to the Bulls Festival. They're demanding the cows run. If the boys run ahead of the bulls, we women have to run with the cows. It's pure logic. Says a tongue-in-cheek petition on a Spanish student website. And here's one. My cat Higgins would be proud of those demanding some rights for kitties. China cat lovers mobilized today to save, or mobilized online to save a truckload of cats destined for the cooking pot. Veteran Shanghai cat rescuer Dong Xirong started off her mission of deliverance on Friday when she called police to stop a truck stuffed with some 800 live cats, the China Daily said. Standoff happened at a parking lot in a southern suburb of Shanghai, continued for hours while cat lovers spread word of the incident online, eventually raising the equivalent of $1,320 in donations to buy the whole load of cats. But they're still eating cats in China. Okay, call about the CIA. And R.J. Hillhouse writing in the Washington Post Sunday, July 8th. This was last Sunday, too. This last Sunday's Washington Post. I don't know how I missed this thing. Red alert. Our national security is being outsourced. The most intriguing secrets in the war on terror have nothing to do with Al-Qaeda and its fellow travelers. They're about the mammoth private spying industry that all but runs U.S. intelligence operations today. Surprised? No wonder. In April, Director of National Intelligence Mike McConnell was poised to publicize a year-long examination of outsourcing by U.S. intelligence agencies, but the report was inexplicably delayed and suddenly classified a national secret. What McConnell doesn't want you to know is that the private spy industry has succeeded where no foreign government has. It has penetrated the CIA and is now running the show. This is from the Washington Post. Over the past 5 years, this is the bizarre logic of the Bushies. The hyper Reagan on steroids is Bush. Over the past 5 years, some say almost a decade, there has been a revolution in the intelligence community toward wide-scale outsourcing. Private companies now perform key intelligence agency functions to the tune, I'm told, of more than $42 billion a year. Intelligence officials tell me that more than 50% of the National Clandestine Service, NCS, the heart, brains, and soul of the CIA, has been outsourced to private firms such as Abraxas, Booz Allen Hamilton, Lockheed Martin, and Raytheon. And then it continues, and you can read it over at the WashingtonPost.com. And thanks for the call and the heads up on that. It's, that's now I'm really worried. Rich in Birmingham, Alabama. Hey, Rich.
Good morning, Tom. Regarding the conservative philosophy, you know, in my opinion, two of the greatest things that happened in the United States in the last century were the GI Bill and mandatory K-12 public education, both expansions of the role of government. And it seems to me that if conservatives really ran the country like a business, they would want to turn liabilities, people that are costing us money by being on welfare, into assets, people that are working, employed, and paying taxes. And the way you do that is through things like the GI Bill and public education, where you invest in your human beings. And I'm just wondering, why do you think there is that disconnect? And I'll hang up and listen. Enjoy the show.
Yeah, thank you, Rich. The disconnect is there because of that magic word, government. They really and truly believe, they can't offer you any logical reason, and in fact we're going to be debating one of them at the top of the next hour. They really and truly believe that if government does it, somehow it's not going to work, but if a private corporation does it, somehow it will. Even if we're talking about the education of people, even if we're talking about investing in people. John in Santa Clara, California. Hey, John.
Hi, Tom. Good morning. Just wanted to point out that Michael Moore has just recently, on his blog, just came out a few minutes ago, accused of CNN of libel, by the way.
Yeah, that was his final charge against them. It's
pretty big,
it's on his
charge there. Yeah. Yeah. Basically, Michael Moore and you guys from Michigan have done a great service, both from the – I listened to your interview with Glee He's been after the corporate elite since Roger and me. He's not a Johnny-come-lately at all. People got to realize that about Michael Moore. And
In fact, go back and rent Roger and Me or The Big One or you know, I mean, if any of his early stuff. If, obviously, Fahrenheit 9/11.
But what we've got here,
Bowling for Columbine.
Mm-hmm, what we've got here, Tom, is an enduring battle between the haves and the have-nots. The .15 that Bush calls his base. Remember in Fahrenheit, I call you my base. The haves and the have-mores.
Right.
The message just hasn't gotten out to the working class that they've been had. You know, it just hasn't gotten out there.
Well, I think they've figured it out. They just don't know why or by whom. And that's why the conservatives are running around going, yeah, you've been had, and you know who's doing it? It's those gays, or it's those people who want equal opportunity. It's those the quota guys, it's the women, or it's the you know, and they just go on and on. It's the liberals. It's the, and they're always throwing something out. It's the godless. It's the, you know, they're always throwing something out as the, these are the guys who are responsible for your ills, when in fact it is the conservative agenda that has been destroying this country, systematically taking this country apart ever since 1981 when Ronald Reagan first flipped us into it.
In your own words, Tom, you know, your ideas come from Madison and Jefferson. Theirs come from Ayn Rand and Ronald Reagan, the B-movie star, and so on. You know, it's really tragic.
Thank you, John. Yeah, it really and truly is tragic. The fact of the matter is 18,000 people a year in this country, as Michael Moore points out in his movie Sicko, 18,000 people a year die because they don't have health insurance. And we're not outraged. We get all flipped out about 3,000 people dying on 9/11. We're not outraged about 18,000 people a year dying?
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio, where smart people get their news.
Well, we spent the last hour talking about right-wing wackos, or maybe left-wing wackos, I don't know, sort of Michael Moore. Kafir Alfia puts himself forward as a bit of an expert on left-wing wackos. He's the co-founder of Protest Warrior, an international organization and website, protestwarrior.com, and the author of a new book, A Field Guide to Left-Wing Wackos and What to Do About Them. Kafir Alfia, welcome to the program.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on your show, Tom.
My pleasure. Is it Kafir or is it Kafir?
Kafir. You said it right the first time.
Okay, great. In your book, you say, due to the fact that they are almost completely insulated from differing political opinions, a fully developed Hollywood activist will often say things that are baffling to the average American. For instance, on April 15, 2003, Tim Robbins said to the National Press Club, quote, in 19 months since 9/11, we've seen our democracy compromised by fear and hatred. Basic inalienable rights, due process, the sanctity of the home have been quickly compromised in a climate of fear, end quote. That's wacko?
Yeah, don't you think it's a little extreme given what was actually going on at the time?
So you think it's just fine that we no longer have the rights of habeas corpus, that you can be on my word, for example, or even if, let's say, a Democrat who doesn't like you was elected president and decides that you're an enemy combatant, that you could be snatched off the streets of Los Angeles or any other city that you happen to be in and imprisoned for the rest of your life without ever facing your accuser, without ever being charged with a crime, without ever having the right to go before a judge? You think that's fine?
I don't think that's actually what's going on.
That's what's in law right now. That's what the Bush administration has decided.
So you're telling me tomorrow I can be picked up because somebody thinks I'm a part of some terrorist group? That's not how it works.
Yes. Yes. No. Well, that's how it worked for Jose Padilla.
Okay.
An American citizen.
Yeah,
and I don't know if you've been paying attention to his trial, but they have introduced absolutely no evidence whatsoever in his trial so far that he did anything, that he even talked about doing anything. There has been no evidence.
Well, how did they try to find evidence? Then there was a trial. So
they were at a certain point they ultimately had to back down, but the administration is still defending their position. that there is no habeas corpus in the United States. You have, you know, frankly, thank God, we've got a couple of rational left-wing wacko Republicans even who are participating and saying, okay, let's bring back habeas corpus. But the Military Commissions Act, doing away with habeas corpus and the John Warner Defense Funding Appropriation Bill, doing away with the Posse Comitatus Act. I mean, now you've got the military in the United States can go against its own people. You think this is good?
Okay, so what you're saying is there is no due process, but there was a trial, and it's all because of left-wing wackos that gave him a due process. Is that what you're saying?
I'm trying to understand why you think that Tim Robbins stating a concern about the loss of civil liberties in the United States as a result of the climate of fear that was exploited by this administration and by a press that saw it as a way to pump up ratings after 9/11. Why you think that that is a bad thing, that somebody would express concern about the loss of the civil liberties that the founders of this country fought and died for 230 years ago?
It's because it's extremist. What he was saying was just to conjure up fear.
He said basic inalienable rights, due process, the sanctity of the home have been quickly compromised in a climate of fear. The Patriot Act says that police can sneak and peek. They can come into your home without a warrant. The Fourth Amendment clearly says that the police can't do that. Which side do you come down on, the Constitution or the Patriot Act?
Of course the Constitution. And to be honest with you, I'm not a huge fan of the Patriot Act, but it's not a complete abrogation of the Constitution.
So it's just a little bad.
Yeah, I would agree with you there.
Kafir, a field guide, the left-wing wackos, the protestwarrior.com. Your book is a caricature of people who love this country and believe in a we society rather than a me society. Yeah, I have it right here in front of me. I spent a fair amount of time with it today. And, yeah, you economic sabotage.
Well, the way we came up with the book was when we started the organization 3 years ago, in San Francisco. I'd never really been to an anti-war protest at the time, but I was living in San Francisco. And when I went to these protests, or when I was driving home from work, I saw a lot of the signs that they were carrying had nothing to do with the war on terror, had nothing to do with 9/11. They were pushing socialism, a lot of anti-capitalism. And I decided to go to one of these protests with a buddy of mine, and we came up with signs that we thought kind of challenged some of the dogma that we were saying. And that's what a lot of it was, is pure dogma. And I'll give you a couple of examples. Protect Islamic property rights against Western imperialism. Say no to war. And then there's a cartoon of a Muslim woman in a burqa with a leash around her neck. We had another slogan. Communism has only killed 100 million people. Let's give it another chance.
Now, why would you suggest that anybody is out there saying that the form of communism or any form of government that killed 100 million people is something that is desirable to the other side? I mean, how can that's
because,
like Bush a Nazi. It's so over the top.
Communist apologists very commonly like to claim that communism is good if it's only implemented properly. But every time it's implemented, it leads to millions of people dying.
So you think that the kibbutz movement in Israel, the country where you were born, there's an active and vibrant kibbutz movement. I've been there. I've seen them, which are communist, pure communists. They read Karl Marx.
Are you calling for
the destruction of the kibbutzim?
You're not going to be machine gunned if you try to leave. There's a big difference there. You can have a commune in your own home. That's no big deal. But once you start pointing a gun to other people and say, you must join this commune, that's something else entirely.
Well, of course. But if you're saying that that communism, period, is bad, I mean, my opinion of communism is that it works if it's fewer than 150 people, and if it's more than 150 people, it doesn't. I mean, that's the social threshold.
Well, communism is a form of government, and the government is going to enforce. You can't have government. You can't have communism just in somebody's home or in a small village.
Well, actually you can, and that's the history of the human race. It's called tribes. But it sounds to me like you're calling for the end of the kibbutz movement in Israel.
No, the kibbutz movement, I don't agree with it, but if it's completely voluntary, that is not communism.
Okay, so
communism
what is socialist or communist about America?
I'm sorry?
What you throughout your book, you talk about the socialists and communists within America, the people who want to make America a socialist or communist country. Are you talking about what, public education? Is that a communist thing or a socialist thing?
Yeah, public.
So public education should be privatized. I'm just trying to right. So you think the public education should be in the hands of for-profit corporations rather than the hands of we the people?
Not necessarily corporations, but it privatization would be something I think would be beneficial.
Why?
Do you think the way the public schools are set up now is anything to boast about?
I went through the public schools in the 1950s and 1960s, and I thought I got a damn good education.
Yeah. So you think the public schools? The way we have
ever since Ronald Reagan came in and put in charge of the Department of Education a guy who said there should be no Department of Education, ever since Bill Bennett did his best to destroy public schools, ever since No Child Left Behind, ever since you guys got a hold, the conservatives got a hold of our educational system, it's been damaged badly. And you guys are trying to destroy it.
What's wrong with making the whole enterprise of education a profit-driven?
Because education is the investment in the future of this country. And if somebody is providing education to my children or to the future generation of this country, I want their first priority to be the education of those children, not how much money they make.
It is, because...
No, it's not. If you start a corporation, by law, you are required to have as your first priority profit.
Exactly. And how do you get that profit? By delivering on your promise of educating the children.
Sometimes you get that profit by screwing the people who work for you. Sometimes you get that profit by delivering a shoddy product. Look at half the health insurance companies in the United States.
Nobody's going to pay you just to stick some teacher is just going to do whatever she wants or whatever he wants and not teach children. If you're going to pay your hard-earned money to give your kids an education, then you're only going to pay the people who can deliver. I don't understand this idea that
so you're saying that the government shouldn't even be paying the. So you're saying that not only should education be private corporations, but the government shouldn't even be paying for it. It should just be the people who can afford to pay for it.
Well, if under the capitalist system, if you made it completely privatized, then you'll have different there'll be obviously different grades of what's available for education.
Yeah, okay.
And if you don't want to pay anything, if you don't want to pay any tax dollars, like let's say right now, if you don't want to pay any tax dollars, then, what do you think?
I got it. Kafir, we're out of time, but I'll refer people to your website for more information. ProtestWarrior.com, the book, A Field Guide to Left-Wing Wackos and What to Do About Them. Kafir, thanks for being on the program with us today.
All right, thank you.
Bye.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
Yes, would you like some education? Let's see how much cash you have in your hand. By the way, Air Americans, head over to airamerica.com. Click on the Tom Hartman page. It'll give you a link into our live chat room. It'll give you a link over to our message board. And it'll also give you a link to our blog. It says Louise Hartman's blog on it, actually. And you can post your comment for today. And David Poole, our producer, will be deciding what is his favorite posting in his totally nefarious fashion. No, nefarious is the wrong. Whimsical fashion. Weird fashion. Whatever. At the end of the show today, and we'll send that person, as a thank you for posting on our blog, we'll send that person a free copy, signed, autographed copy of Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It, my new book. Dwight Eisenhower really framed this debate. I mean, the discussion that I was just having, the conversation with Kafir Afila Kafir Afila, and frankly, most libertarians on these topics boils down to this fundamental debate between what are the boundaries? How much government should we have? What are the boundaries of public function versus private function? And historically, this country has been built on the notion, this core fundamental notion, that Michael Moore so brilliantly exposes the lack of in the area of healthcare in his movie Sicko, the core function, the core fund idea, the foundational idea that those things that have to do with rights, those things that have to do with life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, those things that have to do with the commons, the stuff we collectively own, those are the appropriate functions of government because, number one, the first purpose of government is to accomplish those jobs, not to make a profit, but to actually make sure that people are educated, to make sure that the people are protected by the police, make sure that the country is protected by the army, make sure that our intelligence is provided to us by the CIA, make sure that our homes are protected by the fire departments, that make sure that our food is safe and that our drugs are effective and safe, and that our water supply is pure and that our air can be breathed, and on the list goes, right? To just the fundamental stuff. These are the appropriate functions of government. There's an absolute consensus among Americans about that. But then you got these guys on the Reich who say, no. Those shouldn't be. The only function of government should be to provide for the common defense, not the general welfare. In Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, when they said that government is here to provide for the common defense and the general welfare, the founding fathers should be ignored. When in the preamble to the Constitution, they said that two of the six reasons why this country was created was to provide for the common defense and the general welfare, we should ignore at least five out of the six. Dwight Eisenhower, on the 8th of November in 1954, this is President Dwight Eisenhower, wrote a letter to his brother, Edgar Eisenhower. It's just a private letter. This is not a speech that he was making. It came out after he died. And he said, now, it's true that I believe this, and keep in mind, this is, Dwight Eisenhower was by today's standards, a raving liberal. By the standards of the 1950s, he was a moderate. That is to say, he believed that having a 90% top marginal tax rate was a good thing. He believed that enforcing the antitrust laws was a good thing. He believed that people having the right to unionize was a good thing. He believed that Social Security was a good thing. He was a moderate in the 1950s. He would be called a liberal extremist today by the corporate media. Dwight Eisenhower, writing to his brother, he says, now, it's true that I believe this country is following a dangerous trend when it permits too great a degree of centralization of government functions. I oppose this. In some instances, the fight is a rather desperate one. But to attain any success, it is quite clear that the federal government cannot avoid or escape responsibilities which the mass of the people firmly believe should be undertaken by it. The political processes of our country are such that if a rule of reason is not applied in this effort, we will lose everything, even to a possible and drastic change in the Constitution. This is what I mean by my constant insistence upon moderation in government. Should any political party attempt to abolish Social Security, to abolish unemployment insurance, and to eliminate labor laws and farm programs, you would not hear of that party again in our political history. There's a tiny splinter group, of course, that believes you can do these things. Among them are H.L. Hunt, you possibly know his background, and a few other Texas oil millionaires, and an occasional politician or businessman from other areas, but their number is negligible, and they are stupid. Dwight Eisenhower. President Dwight Eisenhower, in the third year of his presidency, writing a private note to his brother. Should any political party attempt to abolish Social Security, unemployment insurance, or eliminate labor laws and farm programs, you would not hear of that party again in our political history. There's a tiny splinter group, of course, that believes you can do these things. Among them are a few Texas oil millionaires and an occasional politician or businessman from other areas. Their number is negligible, and they are stupid. So well said. So very, very well said. By the way, Senator Vitter is in trouble, and it's not just with the madam. I got to tell you about a cutting incident coming right up.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
One guy apparently who shouldn't have been having those midnight meetings was Senator David Vitter, the Republican from Louisiana. Remember Bob Livingston? Bob Livingston was the senator, the congressman, excuse me, who was one of the leaders, along with Newt Gingrich and Bob Barr, of the move to impeach Bill Clinton in 1998. And it turned out that Bob Barr was having an affair on his second wife with the woman that is now his third wife, and that Newt Gingrich was having an affair on his second wife with the woman who is now his third wife. And Bob Livingston was having an affair, and I don't remember what happened out of that one, but he was having an affair. All three of these guys were having extramarital affairs. Livingston's got outed at the time, and he resigned from Congress. In part because David Vitter called for him to resign. And then went on to say that Clinton should resign as well for having an affair. He says, I think Livingston stepping down makes a very powerful argument that Clinton should resign as well. That was in December 20th, 1998. Well, Senator David Vitter, it turns out his name was on the Hollywood Madam's list of customers. It's apparently been confirmed. And this is where it gets really interesting. Back in 2000, and a tip of the hat to Christy Harvey from the Center for American Progress for passing this along. Back in 2000, his wife, Wendy, Senator Vitter's wife, when asked, you know, if your husband did something like Bill Clinton did, what would you do? I mean, this was like, you know, they were tossing her a softball, right? She says, I'm a lot more like Lorena Bobbitt than Hillary. If he does something like that, I'm walking away with one thing, and it's not alimony, trust me. So, David Vitter, soon to be speaking in a high, squeaky voice. I don't know. Time will tell. Time will tell. And thank you, Bilbo Baggib. Tom, that wasn't fair. You winged that free market turkey with one eye closed. You got to let him run around a bit, get a taste of freedom, then shoot him dead. Over in our blog. Good one. Thank you. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Phil in Palm Harbor, Florida. Hey, Phil, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I don't know if you read about it, but the head of the Chinese FDA, the guy who was responsible...
was just executed.
Executed.
Yeah.
This is the guy who permitted the poisonous export of product to pet users.
Right.
Remember that?
Yeah.
So they made him, quote, responsible, unquote. Now, what happened here in the United States to people like me who lost their cat? Okay? I lost my cat. What did my government do for me? Who was held accountable?
Yeah.
I contacted the pet company. Can I say who it was?
Sure. I'd rather you didn't.
Okay. Well, in any event, I contacted the company. I bought the product at Walmart. It was not the cheapest product. It was the most expensive. I called them up, told them the whole thing, that Sarah died on the 13th of March and all the circumstances and everything else. And I said, I want this documented. I want you to send me a letter stating that I had made this call.
Mm-hmm.
A week later, I got a letter. Oh, we're sorry. And, you know, guess what? What do you think was stapled to the letter?
I don't know what.
A $2 coupon for more cat food.
What company was this?
Imes.
Imes. Huh. I'm astounded that they would be that market insensitive. And frankly, I mean, you know, this is just another example of where the market, you know, there is some truth to the fact that eventually the market corrects when enough people figure out that something's gone wrong. The problem is that it doesn't prevent harm preemptively.
That's right.
If enough people's pets die, then, you know, something gets done, well, by the free market. Whereas if the system is actually, you know, regulate, if we the people get together and say we want to know that our food and our pets' food is safe, and we want to know it in advance, And so we're going to take care of this. Then you don't have to worry about that. And in fact, it was back in the first century, the first decade of the 20th century, that the death of humans, was, you know, getting so bad. I think it was it Upton Sinclair or Sinclair Lewis? I always mix them up. You know, wrote that novel, I think it was called The Jungle, about the meatpacking industry. It so horrified people that, you know, it led to the passage of the pure drug and food laws. You know, it's just because people in America were dying. They were dying from our drugs and they were dying from our food. So, you know, Phil, good point. And thank you very much for calling. But it also, you know, the execution of this guy in China also points out the fact that you can have a capitalist system and an absolute dictatorship at the same time. In fact, that's normally the way it works. Look at the history of Europe. For thousands of years, all the way back to Gilgamesh, 7,000 years, you had capitalist systems operating in Europe and in the pre-European, quote, Western civilizations. And they were almost always led by kings, warlords, or queens, basically royal families. You can have absolute despotism and capitalism at the same time. These people who think that capitalism is going to bring about small-d democracy are wrong. They're just wrong. Lee in Duval, Washington. Hey, Lee.
Hey, Tom. Talking about your free market versus the government control of things, you know, one of the most devious things is I heard Michael Medved on a local Seattle right wing. I think he's nationally syndicated. He was debating with a guy a while back on the oil profits, the obscene oil profits, and he was defending those. And the guy mentioned something about government this, and he said, well, the companies don't make the rules. The government makes the rules. Well, that's what's so devious about that is right now we have a White House, a complete administration that is almost entirely made up of the oil industry. So when they say the government makes the rules, that's just nothing but a lie.
This is the cancer stage of capitalism. When capitalism reaches the point where it reaches out for the control of and takes control of institutions of government, it has metastasized. It has reached the cancer stage. It's reached the stage where it's starting to kill its host. And that's where we're at right now. And it needs to be brought back. And I'm not talking about ending capitalism by any stretch of the imagination. I'm all in favor of capitalism in a regulated fashion, in a regulated environment. Capitalism, free enterprise, great engines for prosperity and progress and could even be, you know, positive forces for helping save this world if properly regulated, as we once did in this country and we can do again. And as most Western, you know, fully developed democracies do. Julie in Grosse Pointe, Michigan. Hey, Julie.
Hi, Tom. I want to say, first of all, how much I love your show. As a well-read person, what's great about your show is how much I learn. I know everyone feels that way, though. But at any rate, did you hear what happened this morning on the Diane Rehm show on NPR?
No, I did not.
A White House insider called up. He said his name was Richard. He said he'd give Diane his last name once they got off the air. But he was calling up to say how disgusted and disillusioned he was with the White House policies on, this is all about Iraq. But the big thing, and I didn't get to hear all of what he said by a long shot because I'm working, but he said that the White House has decided there's absolutely no way they're leaving Iraq, that they're, you know, how they're planning this whole thing is that, and this is a quote, in the ultimate gotcha, they're going to leave Iraq to the next president. You know, it's right. This whole spoiled brat, you know, George Bush, or as I call him, the shrub, way of doing things.
Yeah, yeah. It's been, you know, fairly obvious, I think, for some time that that's his goal, that he doesn't want to go down in history as the guy who lost Iraq. And Julie, thank you very much for pointing that out. What he doesn't, you know, I am guessing that Bush thinks that Nixon went down in history as the guy who lost Vietnam. And actually, my recollection is that it was the Jerry Ford administration. Jerry Ford was in office when the last soldiers came home from Vietnam. Somebody correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think so. Greg Mitchell, who's the editor and publisher, which is the inside magazine for the publishing industry, has just written an editorial or an op-ed piece or whatever you call it, an article, actually, in news reporting, in which he says the same New York Times reporter who on his own, he's talking about Michael Gordon, the same New York Times reporter who on his own or with Judith Miller wrote some of the key yet badly misleading or downright inaccurate stories about Iraqi WMDs in the run-up to the 2003 invasion is now writing scare stories that offer ammunition for the growing chorus of neocons calling for a U.S. strike against Iran. I've noticed that, in fact, on the local show here on KPOJ this morning, I was talking with Carl about this. I've noticed the last 2 days in a row, the top story on the New York Times, nytimes.com, has been, oh, let's not pull out of Iraq too fast. It could be a disaster. And then, you know, of course, all the singing about Iran, you know, all that, oh, you got to do something about Iran. Oh, no. Linda in Daly City, California. Hey, Linda, what's up?
Linda? Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. You know, I was going to say that you bring together two things that you've been talking about, and that's Dwight Eisenhower and the condition of the roads. Remember that Dwight Eisenhower was the daddy of the interstate highway system.
Right, right. And in fact, it was promoted as something that would help rebuild America, help build America's, an economic engine. There is a, you know, kind of a Vanishing Hitchhiker story that it was also promoted as a defense thing, and some small amount of truth to it, but it wasn't there's not a large amount of truth to it. It was basically just, hey, you know, let's do this, and let's build the infrastructure of this country, along with bridges and dams and schools and hospitals.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
I took my problem to the KGB. Said there's this guy who won't agree with me. They took Litvinenko for some sushi and some wine, and just a little portion of Polonium-209. He looked suspicious when he saw his dish. He said it isn't safe to eat raw fish. They said, it's okay, hey, the sushi is just fine. We're sure E. coli can't survive Polonium-209. We thought that Litvinenko would have made a fast break. His sake smelled like something they dredged out of a lake. What's more, the guy who served him was named Igor the Snake. And though he didn't order it, he got a shake. If I should take you out for tea or fruit, it's best to bring a radiation suit. And though I've noticed frequently my dinner guests decline, but hey, it tastes like chicken. Polonium-209.
Have you noticed that since George W. Bush spent the weekend with Vladimir Putin, although nothing, you know, there was no word announced, there were no announcements that any kind of rapprochement or consequences came out of that meeting, any result came out of that meeting, that Bush's hair seems to be getting gray really, really fast. You wonder, you know, did Vladimir offer him some sushi? Yeah, who knows? 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Andrew in Blaine, Washington. Hey, Andrew, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks, Tom. I love your show.
Thank you.
Hey, just noting that your last guest you have on has seemed to have a common thread with the people that I usually have my water cooler arguments with. They seem to be uninformed or underinformed. I noticed that here in Bellingham, when people need to get books or whatnot, they have to spend usually nearly half a month's pay and whatnot to get them.
Wow. So you mean students?
Yeah.
Are you talking about college?
Oh, yeah.
College, you know, people who are like working and going to college, that kind of thing.
Oh yeah.
Or
have to pay more than $100 for a single book.
Yeah. It's totally out of control, and it's like, hey, let's all make a profit on this. You're absolutely right, Andrew. Thanks a lot, and good point made. Michelle in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Hey, you want to talk about your senator? We were talking about David Vitter here just a minute ago.
Aren't we proud today, Tom?
Well, you know, here's the question. If David Vitter, he's a Republican, if he, you know, came to power on the back of Clinton's having had an affair and Livingston's having had an affair, and now he gets busted for, you know, buying the services of a prostitute, how should his constituents respond to him? I would say if he had not made sexual sexually inappropriate behavior, let's call it. If he had not made that the cornerstone of his senatorial campaign and his rise to power, then, you know, I'd give him a pass and say it's his private life. He's entitled to do what he wants. But he has. How do the people of Louisiana, and what do you think about this, Michelle?
Well, certainly I didn't vote for him. But that's what I was calling to tell you, Tom. He and the other Republicans have set the bar so high, it's their own fault. I'm calling his office this afternoon to demand his resignation. I don't think an apology is enough. He brought this on himself, you know, and he decided to turn around and behave in the exact same manner that he refused to let others behave in. And being Mr. Holier than thou, he should step down.
Yeah, see, that's the point where I draw the line as well, is if, you know, it kind of what's good for the goose is good for the gander sort of thing. If you're going to, you know, those who, there's no end of the cliches, you know, people who live in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. If he was, on the other hand, somebody who was relatively libertarian, in at least in, with regards to things like prostitution, if he was on the record as saying he thought that prostitution should be decriminalized, or that whatever people do in private, you know, it should be their own business, that people should, you know, people should have expanded rights in those areas, you know, then I'd have no problem with it. But it's the exact opposite. So it's hypocrisy. It's the hypocrisy, stupid, I guess, is where we get to, right, Michelle?
I completely agree, Tom.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for the call. Well said. Ron in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Ron, what's up?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Speaking of the FDA, as we did earlier, there is a rancher that somewhere in the West, and I can't remember where, it was in the Rocky Mountain News or the Denver Post within the last month, that they want to do full testing of their herd for mad cow disease.
Right, so they can sell them into Japan.
Right, and the government will not allow them to do that, that they must do only samplings.
That's right, and that's why I said we are now at the cancer stage of capitalism, because what has happened is that the government is now responding to the cattlemen's industry. The cattle industry lobby is huge and very, very powerful, and this administration has been dancing to the tune of the largest and most powerful industries in this country, including the food industry. And the food industry says, we don't want to pay for testing. We don't want people to ask for testing. We don't want to see any food at all showing up with a label that says, this cow has been tested and it's safe. And because it's going to cost us money, we would all have to test if somebody starts testing. And so we want you to ban any testing. And that's the situation we have in the United States. In Japan, 100% of all beef has to have been tested to be sold, which is why U.S. beef can't be sold in Japan. In the United States, 100% of all beef cannot be tested by law. And that's, as I said, that's the cancer stage of capitalism, and it's a terrible, terrible thing. Thanks a lot for pointing that out, Ron. Chris in Dublin, California. Hey, Chris, just got about a half a minute here before we got to wrap this show up, or this hour anyway.
Real quick, Tom, I was seething when you were doing an interview with Kafir. He said that made a point that the way in which corporations make profit is by delivering a quality product to their customers. And you can say what you want about Michael Moore, and people can criticize whether or not his films are true or not, but I watched footage in the film last night in Sicko of this former executive, female of the insurance industry, testifying before a congressional panel that she was given career and promotional incentives for denying the very care that company is required to care to its customers. Now, you can't tell
right.
me that that's how they're making profit by delivering
profit. Spot on. Yeah, it's a perfect example. It's another reason why everybody has to get out there and see Sicko, because it's an incredible movie. Coming up next, Joseph A. Califano Jr. about our drug laws. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Tom Hartman Program, Viagra for your brain. This is Air America Radio.
Speaking of Viagra, let's talk drugs. Welcome back to the third hour of our program. Joseph A. Califano Jr. is the chairman and president of the National Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse at Columbia University. And he's written a new book. It's called High Society, How Substance Abuse Ravages America and What to Do About It. Joseph Califano, Jr., welcome to the program.
Nice to talk to you.
Good having you on the show here. I've spent a fair amount of time with your book. I find it fascinating. You've done a really good job of documenting the damage that is done to American society by drug abuse, particularly alcohol and tobacco. I'm a little concerned about some of your solutions, but first of all, do you want to just take a shot at the damage that the drugs are doing in this society?
Sure, I do. You know, my phone. Hello?
Yeah.
Hello?
Yes. Can sir, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here, but
You're not there anymore. Okay. They're going to try and call you back. In the meantime, I want to share with you, speaking of public health, Dr. Carmona, the previous Richard Carmona, he was George Bush's first Surgeon General from 2000 to 2006, 2002 to 2006. Second Surgeon General, testifying before Congress just about an hour ago. Here's what he had to say. This is a mind-boggling about how his office was politicized.
They said that they had all been challenged and had to fight political battles in order to do their job.
He's talking about his peers, the previous Surgeon General.
But each agreed that never had they seen Washington, D.C. so partisan or a new Surgeon General so politically challenged and marginalized as during my tenure. They told me that although most Americans believe that their Surgeon General has the ability to impact the course of public health as the nation's doctor, the reality is that the nation's doctor has been marginalized and relegated to a position with no independent budget and with supervisors who are political appointees with partisan agendas. Anything that doesn't fit into the political appointee's ideological, theological, or political agenda is often ignored, marginalized, or simply buried.
This is the second Attorney General under the Bush administration, George Bush's second Attorney General, testifying before Congress today about how his office was, quote, blocked at every turn, told the decision had already been made, stand down, don't talk about, in this case, stem cell research, and that he had political appointees who were specifically assigned to, quote, vet my speeches, spin my words in such a way that would be preferable to a political or ideologically preconceived notion that has nothing to do with science. The tragedy. Joseph Califano, Jr., back on the line with us. Are you there, sir, with a functional
I'm here, Tom. Sorry.
Okay, great. No, that's fine. Glad to have you back. Yeah, we were going to start out with the problem of drug abuse in America.
Well, the damage. I mean, people don't realize that substance abuse, now this is across the board. This is alcohol, tobacco, illegal drugs, prescription drug abuse, across the board. We look at it, we're talking about the number one culprit in terms of crime in America. If you look at our prisons, 80% of the people in prison have committed their offense while they were high, incidentally, mostly on alcohol, more on alcohol than on drugs, stole money to buy drugs, are drug addicts or alcoholics, or violated the alcohol or drug laws. So we have this enormous criminal system. In the healthcare system, when you think about it, the greatest cause and exacerbator, well, first of all, about half the hospital beds in America are filled with people who are there because of smoking, drinking, drug use, or the accidents or violence, the kidney diseases, the cancers, the heart diseases, the strokes related to use of these substances. It is devastating to our kids. I think we're really wasting a lot of our best and brightest. A tremendous proportion of our, about half of our high, of our college, full-time college students, are alcohol abusers or drug abusers, and about almost 25% of them meet the clinical criteria for addiction or abuse. In terms of the welfare system, the women on welfare, most of the women now remaining on welfare have drug or alcohol problems. They get no treatment. We have a welfare system in which we're saying that these women, you got to get off the rolls after a certain period of time, and stand on your own two feet, but we refuse to give them the thing they need to stand on their own two feet, which is some treatment.
In other words, this is a medical issue. It's a public health problem that we are trying to treat with wagging our finger in their face lectures, cutting off services, and the criminal justice system.
Absolutely. This is a disease. One of the central points in the book is substance abuse is a disease. It is terribly stigmatized. It is not a moral failing. It is not an easily disposed of habit. And just think about, if you're an American, you know, how hard it is to diet. Well, multiply that by 1,000 and you get a sense of how hard it is to stop drinking if you're an alcoholic, or stop using drugs if you're hooked. And, right. And we don't invest the money in research that we should. The National Institutes of Health have been savaged this year and by the administration's budget cuts.
Would you agree, sir, that if we were to start addressing substance abuse in this country as a disease right across the board, including tobacco and including all the illegal drugs, and instead of treating it as a law enforcement problem, number one, we could probably cut half our inmate population. We have the largest inmate population in the world, well over twice that of any Western European country, that we would be more in line with those other countries that deal with it that way?
Well, I think other countries have problems too, but no, I think absolutely. One, if, what we've done is by just dumping these people in prison. We have them in prison. Just think about this for a minute, Tom. The most expensive cost of treatment is the residence part of it. We have that. For a couple of, we're paying $45,000, $50,000 a year to incarcerate people. For another couple of $1,000s, we could give them drug and alcohol treatment. By not giving them anything in prison, what do we have? When they get out, we have a price support program for drug dealers and the liquor industry.
We're talking with Joseph Califano, Jr. He's the chairman and president of the National Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse at Columbia University. His new book, High Society, How Substance Abuse Ravages America. And, sir, when this country was founded, you could walk into any store and you could buy laudanum, which was opium. You could buy coca extract, which was cocaine. It was actually just, it wasn't like today's street cocaine, but it was there. It became Coca-Cola in the early 1913, I think it was. And people grew pot. And it was generally viewed as no big deal. I've seen studies that suggest that about 10% of people, that we all have these THC receptors in our brain, about 10% of people are just genetically wired to have some sort of an interaction with, at the very least, plant-based drugs. Why not consider like the Dutch do and just say, that's cool. If those people want to use those substances, let them use them.
Well, one, it's been a disaster for the young people in Holland. They have a much higher rate of drug addiction than we have in the United States of America among the young people. And number two, analogous to that, with respect to alcohol, countries that have no age limits or very minimal age limits have enormous drink. I mean, England has a drinking problem as big as ours is that dwarfs our drinking problem, particularly among their young people. I do not think in any way, shape, or form legalizing drugs make any sense.
And yet in Germany, I lived in Germany for a year, you can walk into any restaurant and have your 5-year-old served a glass of wine. And they don't seem to have quite the alcohol problem we have here, or do they?
Maybe I think Germany does not have an alcohol problem nearly as severe as the United Kingdom does.
Is it a cultural problem or a law problem?
Well, it's an interesting point, Tom. I mean, there is something. That is affected by our culture. I mean, I'll just give you one. It's a kind of an incredible example.
We only have about 20 seconds.
All right, 20 seconds. I'm going to quote the Pope, okay?
Yeah, go for it.
Marxism has left a sad heritage of economic and ecological destruction. Capitalism has failed to bridge the distance between the rich and poor and is giving rise to a worrying degradation of personal dignity through drugs, alcohol, and deceptive illusions of happiness. We do have a cultural problem.
Yeah, we very much do, and an economic one as well that seems to be driving a lot of it. But that's a whole other conversation. Joseph A. Califano, Jr., High Society, the book, How Substance Abuse Ravages America, What to Do About It. Sir, thanks for being on the program.
Okay, thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on listener-supported radio, supported by you, supporting our sponsors. Let our sponsors know, let our radio stations know as well that you're listening, that you appreciate the program. Sponsors like, first of all, the local sponsors on your local radio station, they're the top of the priority list. And then secondly, our national sponsors like Sacred Grounds Coffee, sacredgroundscoffee.com, Small Dog Electronics, smalldog.com. The Organic Wine Company, 1-888-ECO-WINE for imported organic French wines. Give them a call. 21 minutes past, I think I said that. Here's what I don't get. I've stomped around in the mountains around, well, it's quite a ways from Lima, Peru, but the mountains of Peru. And where people just chew coca leaf all the time. I mean, yeah, they grow it and they chew it. With a little bit of lime, not the fruit, the mineral. And well, and I suppose it's not illegal to say it on the air. I was in Peru after all, and I chewed some too as I was walking in these high elevation with these folks and these were indigenous people. And my experience of it was that it was sort of like drinking a strong cup of coffee. It was certainly nothing more than that. In Afghanistan for 1,000 years, and in parts of Asia, people have been growing opium poppies and smoking opium. People were smoking pot in North America for 20,000 years. The natives down in Brazil make ayahuasca from a couple of herbs. It seems to me that the problem is when we get technology into it. And, just follow this logic for a minute. And then, if you have an opposing view, I'd love to hear it, or you want to set me straight on this. Back in the early 70s, I was a partner in a company that made herbal teas. It was the one business that I've started, Louise and I've started in all these years. Actually, we had another partner that ultimately didn't make it. And we got our lunch was eaten by Celestial Seasonings. God bless Mo Siegel. He beat us in the game of business. But for a couple of years we were doing pretty well and we were making a fair amount of money. And I was at one point looking at flavorings that could be added to the herbs to juice the teas a little bit. And we never did this, but I contacted these companies that sold flavorings. And their biggest customers, this very, very large company that I contacted, their biggest customer was the tobacco industry. And they had all these chemicals, and some of these chemicals were so toxic that you couldn't handle them with your bare hands. And one of them was ammonia. And I'm like, why would you put ammonia in tobacco? And the guy said, well, the tobacco company started doing this in the 1950s, and the reason that they put ammonia in tobacco is to freebase the nicotine. Because when Native Americans smoked tobacco back, before Europeans showed up, it was occasional, it was ceremonial, and they didn't get addicted to it. Or very, very few of them did. Because, raw tobacco is it's not that big a deal. But if you can make the nicotine, if you can change it from being an acidic molecule, which is slowly absorbed into the bloodstream, into an alkaline molecule, because the blood is basically acidic, you make it into an alkaline molecule, then when it hits the lung wall, it just goes bang right into the bloodstream and bang right across the blood-brain barrier into the brain. He says the same way with cocaine. If you take cocaine and you make it alkaline, it has a whole lot more kick and dramatically more addiction. And that's called freebased or crack cocaine. So what the tobacco companies have been selling in the United States since basically just after World War II is freebased nicotine. crack nicotine, crack cigarettes. Cigarettes that are sold today, the tobacco that is sold today is crack of nicotine. And it just, you know, and we look at all the problems that are associated with it. I mean, Joe Califano in his book, he lists all of the deaths and diseases that have been caused by tobacco in the United States. Well, yeah, we're selling crack tobacco. And I'm just, you know, we have, Terrence McKenna wrote about this at some length. He's no longer with us, so we can't have him on the program. He died of brain cancer a couple of years ago. But he explored a lot of Aboriginal and Indigenous societies. True Hallucination is one of his great books. And he was of the opinion, and this guy's a serious scientist, was of the opinion that we co-evolved with plants and with plant substances and were essentially designed to use them. And we all do. I mean, I'm sitting here drinking green tea right now. It's got a xanthine alkaloid. It's actually got about a dozen psychoactive alkaloids in it. The primary one is caffeine. But there's a whole bunch of secondary xanthines in there. People will go home and they'll have some chocolate, which contains theobromine, which is another mind-altering alkaloid, another plant substance. So maybe it should just be, if it's an absolute natural substance and you grow it in your own backyard, no problem. And that would satisfy that small percentage of people who need to alter their brain for some reason. And for anything that gets into commerce, though, we're going to say, no, you can't do that. You can't get it into commerce. I don't know. Maybe it would work. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Enough. There was an enough protest in Portland here this last weekend. The people out there with a sign that simply said, enough! They're springing up all over the United States. Enough. I was baffled to hear Joe Califano say that the drug policy in Holland is not working. And so I went over to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services study. This is the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration National Household Survey of Drug Abuse, Volume 1, Summary of National Findings, 2002, page 109, table H1, and found that in the United States, lifetime prevalence of marijuana use, ages 12 plus, 36.9%. Now, you compare that with a study done by the European Monitoring Center for Drugs and Drug Addiction, the same year, November 2002, from a study, the report to the EMC-DDDA by the Retox National Focal Point, the Netherlands Drug Situation 2002, page 28, table 2. Those are the basis for comparison. In other words, the official European study of drug addiction in Europe versus the official U.S. government study of drug use in the United States. Okay, so we're comparing apples to apples. And this is all for the year 2001. So we're comparing apples to apples in the same year. Lifetime prevalence of marijuana use in the USA, 36.9%. Lifetime prevalence of marijuana use in the Netherlands, 17%. Where you can walk into any coffee shop and buy pot and smoke pot. Past month's prevalence of marijuana use in 2001 in the United States, 5.4%. In Holland, 3%. Lifetime prevalence of heroin use, 1.4% in the United States. In Holland, 0.4%, 0.4%. Incarceration rate per 100,000 population. In the U.S., 701. 700 out of every 100,000 people in the United States are in prison. In the Netherlands, 100. I would say, I don't know where he's getting his numbers from, but it doesn't look like the same place I'm getting my numbers from. One of the folks posted on the blog, by the way, over at airamerica.com, that his wife is a German national and that the drinking age in Germany is 16. Yes, that's true. And as I said, I lived there. I know that's true. The fact of the matter is, though, and I'm unless your German wife lived in perhaps some big city where things were scrupulously enforced, that it was not at all uncommon for us when we would go out in Germany to see an entire family where every person at the table had a glass of wine in front of them, and the kids would drink the wine. And it wasn't like they were drinking to get drunk. It was like they were drinking as part of a celebration or something like that. And I remember on Father's Day in Germany, the kids, our youngest was 5, our middle child was 8, and our oldest was 13 the year that we lived in Germany. And on Father's Day, our 8-year-old went with his friends to the liquor store to buy a bottle of liquor, of whiskey, or of bourbon or scotch or whatever it was, for me. And his friends all, and they all came over, and they're all, each one of them's carrying this bottle of liquor that they bought for their parents for Father's Day. I mean, it's a very, very laid back there. So, and they don't have that hysterical alcohol problem. So, yeah, I don't know. I as I said, I think that there's something cultural about the whole thing as well. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. John in Vancouver, Washington. Hey, John, what's up?
Hi, I've been waiting all these years to say hello to Mr. Califano. I'm sorry he left. I remember back in 1978, this country was finally moving toward a sane policy on drugs, you know, sorting through them, you know, which, what's bad, you know, what should we do with this drug, this, this? And then for some reason, some scandal, which I forget what it was, the drug czar at the time, or the equivalent, whatever we called him, was forced to resign. And Mr. Califano became the new drug czar, and his first pronouncement was, all illegal drugs are bad, all illegal drugs are to be treated the same way, and all illegal drug users are sick. Now, the fact that he labeled them sick gave him a liberal aura, but actually he was hard right, and he's been, ever since then, he's been on all the talk shows as the liberal spokesperson. And so the people who want a sane drug policy in this country don't even get a seat at the table because of people like Mr. Califano. I would say he has about as much credibility on the subject of drugs as Joe Lieberman does on the subject of Iraq.
Interesting. John, thank you for that background. I appreciate it. That's very interesting. Judy in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Judy, what's up?
Oh, is it me?
It's you.
Oh, okay.
Pick up your phone, please.
Are you there?
I am here.
Hi, I am sorry.
And you are on the air. And okay, if you would pick up the phone and take us off the speakerphone, or I'm going to have to drop the line.
Is it off now?
I don't think so.
Boy, it sounds like it's off.
Okay, Judy, I'm going to put you on hold, and we'll see what we can work out. Ray in Colorado. Hey, Ray, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. In reference to what you were talking about before, about the way conservatives want to privatize everything. Have you ever heard of the wise use agenda?
Yeah, it was a euphemism for let's convert our natural resources into money for big corporations, particularly those that have to do with minerals and wood.
Yeah, I'm just so glad you've heard of it, because so few people, especially in the Midwest and East, have ever heard of that. And that's basically been the blueprint for the Bush administration's domestic policies.
Yeah, it started with the Reagan administration.
I'm sorry?
It started with the Reagan administration.
Yeah,
James Watt was, I think, one of the, was, yeah. I could be wrong, but I think James Watt was the guy who really rolled it out when he was the Secretary of the Interior.
Yeah, and it was the privatization of national parks and all that kind of stuff, turn them into Disney worlds. And what people don't realize is that's been going on during the Bush administration, and that Pombo from California, he was probably one of the biggest proponents of that. And the thing that scares me about the Bush administration more than what they've done already is I have a feeling before they leave it's going to be a scorched earth policy. I mean, I think they're going to do so many things right when they walk out the door that it's going to take a new administration months or maybe years to fix it. So.
Yeah, well, they already have. That's the tragedy, Ray. They already have. And that's why we need to get active right now. Judy in Seattle, let's try this again. Hey, Judy.
Hi. I was calling because of the comments that the one gentleman that you had on was making about people who have eating disorders. And can you imagine what it's like to have a drug or alcohol addiction, and it's so much worse. And I just wanted to say I beg to differ with them. I had parents who were alcoholics. My brother died of alcoholism, so I know the problems that are involved with that. I myself don't have that problem, but I do have an eating disorder. I am way overweight, and the difference being is that if they went to their doctors, they could get treatment that was covered by their insurance. When I go to the doctor, if I need to have some help with my weight control, I get no help from my insurance. I am on my own.
Which makes really, ultimately, even from the insurance company's point of view, no sense, because if you were able to lose weight, you'd reduce the risk factors for a whole lot of diseases that they may have to pay for down the road.
Exactly. I mean, you know, I'm having problems with my knees. You know, I'm horribly at risk of diabetes, heart disease, all those other things that go with obesity. But I can't get the help that I need through my insurance company. And if I don't have the money to go to a private clinic, I'm just, you know, there. And the difference being is that, and I know this sounds trite, but, you know, you can stop drinking. It's difficult, but you can stop drinking. You can stop using drugs. But you can't stop eating. And the entire marketing system in this country is geared for you to go out and get the triple Whopper with cheese.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, there are so many people in this country who have a weight problem that can't get any help whatsoever.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, for people who are drug addicts who are looking for rehab, most insurance will not cover that either. I don't know about alcohol, but
alcohol, I know for a fact that alcohol is, and a lot of drug abuse will be covered by insurance. Not all of them, obviously, but
you know, this does, Judy, is it just so illustrates the point that Michael Moore is making in his movie Sicko, that we need to become a we society rather than a me society. We need to have a national health care system. We need to say these are fundamental rights, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which includes the right to life. Thank you very much. And that means that, you know, let's take care of people who are alive. And a national health care program would be a really great place to start. Judy, thank you for your call and your comments, and good luck in your ongoing struggle with life. Emery in Hollywood Hills, California. Hey, Emery.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Great. Got to take a break in about a minute here.
Okay, I come with some expertise because I'm the longest surviving hunger striker in the history of the world connected to legalization, and it's well documented. But the reason why, first of all, the Native Americans.
In other words, you can stop eating. Louise and I used to fast back when we were in our 20s. We would fast for, you know, I think the longest we ever did was 10 days. But that's, you know, that's really not practical for most people. And it's
I went 79. It was on a county courthouse front step.
Whoa.
But back in 97, you can Google search my name, but it doesn't really matter. 20,000 years, the Native Americans did not smoke marijuana. The marijuana came to the United States by the white man with our first boats here as sails and everything else.
Oh, really? We brought it here from Europe?
What? They brought it here from Europe. In fact, the Bible for 1,100 years was printed solely on hemp. The first draft of the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, Betsy Ross's flag, every single soldier that wore a uniform all the way up until 1947.
It was all hemp.
All hemp.
Yeah.
And that's
I know that.
Drugs
yeah.
Exist.
Yep, and yeah, indeed. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
Lock up your whiskey cabinets. Girls, lock up your guns. Lock up the beauty shop. And no telling if they've heard the news. Call a boy downtown and leave a market. Tell him lock up some high-heeled shoes. When God-fearing women get the blues.
Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Hey, congratulations to our, winner's the wrong word, David, our selectee, perhaps, I don't know what you call it, it's a half glass full, congratulations.
Roosevelt is dead.
Well, why does Limbaugh keep showing up whenever I'm, there we go, yeah, there we go, yeah, I should do it. Thank you very much. Congratulations to half glass full, he's the best post in David's opinion today over on the AirAmerica.com/Tom Hartman page. He says, this is a very serious sin in my past for which I am, of course, completely responsible. Vitter said in a statement, several years ago, I asked for and received forgiveness from God. And Half Glass Full says, that's funny. Just the other night I was talking to God, and he said, not only is David Vitter a whoremonger, but he's also a damned liar. So, there we go. Robin Simon is with us. Robin is here to talk about the possibility. She's the vice president of communications for the National Women's Political Caucus, California chapter, NWPCCA.org. National Women's Political Caucus, California. What's A, Robin?
What's that, Tom? First of all, thank you so much for having me on your show today.
Sure. NWPCCA.
Yes.
Association? Yeah, okay,
.org. National Women's Political Caucus, California. So NWPCCA.
.org. There you go.
Yes.
Got it. Okay, so the mission that you have set your sights on is to have 50-50 participation in elections, men and women, by 2020. Where are we right now?
Okay. Well, let me clarify just a bit. It's the campaign is 50-50 by 2020. And what that means is 50% representation by women and 50% by men by the year 2020. And the significance of the year is that the 2020 marks the 100th anniversary of the year that women obtained the right to vote. And when NWPC leaders got together some years ago, back in 2003, they realized that if we continued on the path that we were on with the incremental successes of women entering into elected office, it would take us some 200 years to reach 50-50 political parity, gender parity. And we thought, my goodness, those are some staggering numbers, and we can't possibly wait 200 more years to have the political elected offices held by 50-50. So
aren't we like something like 16 or 18% right now nationwide in terms of women in elected office?
It depends on the state and it depends on the elected office. I mean, California ranks right now, compared to other states, 15th. So in California, we're doing okay compared to the rest of the country. We currently have 19 women state senators. We have 24 state assembly women in office. We have our first constitutional officer with Senator Deborah Bowen. We've never had a lieutenant governor or governor, a woman in the state of California, which is somewhat surprising for given the demographics of our state. So while we're doing okay in California, throughout the country, those numbers are still significantly low. Throughout the country, women in constitutional offices hold 77 seats.
Which is what percentage?
If you were to break it down, I couldn't do the math so fast.
Fairly low. It would be under 10%.
A lot, because you're talking about governor, lieutenant governor, secretary of state, so on and so on.
So it's under 10%. If you're trying to reach 50%, Robin, I'm curious. Mm-hmm. I'm curious. What do you think is it that has prevented this from happening? Other than the obvious glass ceiling and the old boy network and discrimination and all that, are women participating in the political process now?
Yes, they are, and I'm going to answer that question, and I'm so grateful that you asked that question, because given those obvious factors that you just mentioned, it really is much deeper than that. Women are surpassing men in college enrollment, they are starting more businesses, and they vote in larger numbers than men. However, we are still less likely to seek public office, and yes, the factors are given that we are still the primary caretakers of our children, and we weigh very heavy on that decision to enter elected office because we do have families. We also do, on an average, are only still making 3/4 of what males are earning, so we don't always have the resources that it takes to seek public office, which, as we all know, is absurd amounts of money. We also are not, women are not equipped to be, we need to learn how to be better askers for money. Men seem to go right out there and raise that capital and raise.
Or why don't we just try to have a political system that doesn't require that? I mean, there's also... Isn't there also a brutality factor? I mean, I know people in elected office and the brutal attacks that they get are just mind-boggling it seems that men perhaps for whatever reason probably culturally are better equipped to respond to that or more likely or more willing to deal with that in that world than women are.
Absolutely, which is why the National Women's Political Caucus, one of our primary missions is to recruit and train women. We offer comprehensive campaign training workshops to teach women the tools to be successful and to be successful candidates, because it's not about the policies. It's not about whether or not they're going to make better leaders. It's about getting there and how are we going to get them there, and we need to set them up and train them, and that's NWPC does an excellent job in recruiting women and then training them and staying with them the whole way. I wanted to get back to some of the other stats that you mentioned earlier. I wanted to tell you that in California, in the year 2006, we had 308 legislative candidates from both of the major parties qualify, okay, for the ballot. Out of that 308, only 91 of them were women. So we really need to do a better job in encouraging women to even seek public office.
Robin Simon, we have to wrap it up, Robin, but I thank you so much for the great work you're doing. People can check out your website, NWPCCA.org. NWPCCA.org. And by the way, I think the Iroquois had it right. In five of the six Iroquois nations, only women could vote. I mean, they understood what was going on. 57 minutes past the hour. Coming up tomorrow, conservative Eli Lehrer and I are going to debate whether government can protect us from electricity blackouts and airport security problems. And David Hatcher Childress is going to talk about the mystery of the Olmecs. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.